a new recording for the start of Perek Yud Bet of chapter 12. If you actually jump for a minute to the end of the sheet, the back page, I gave you a summary, a very brief outline, clearly missing a lot, of where we've been within the book. Just, you know, it's not as extensive as I did for the Yeshaya shir, because Yeshaya needs a lot. But just a little bit of where we've been. So they had the opening two prakim, right? The dynamic between Chana and Penina and the husband Elkanah. She goes to daven at the Mishkan. I didn't go into the whole Eli judgment thing, which you remember from that story. Shmuel is born. She sings a song, which we interpreted on multiple levels, as a song of gratitude, as a song of philosophy about Hashem's role in the world, as a prophecy of what would happen with this son Shmuel and with Shaul and David. Then we saw the Eli's sons, Hophni and Pinchas, and how they abuse the Mishkan for their own enrichment, while Shmuel grows up to be wonderful. Eli gets warnings about his kids, first from this anonymous Ish Elokim, and then from Shmuel. And then, in Prakim 4 to 6, Dalet Zavav, the decision, let's take the Aron to war against the Plishtim, perhaps that's Hophni and Pinchas who make that decision, they're certainly a part of it. The Aron is lost, and the curse on the house of Eli starts to take effect. Hophni and Pinchas die, Eli dies, the wife of Pinchas dies in childbirth. The Aron is held by the Plishtim, who suffered terribly. We have the whole thing with the Tchorim, which we definitely do not want to revisit in this outline. They are suffering either in order to get them to turn over the Aron, or as a punishment for putting the Aron with their idols, and as though they had defeated it, or as a demonstration that God is greater than their Avodah Zarah. We give different approaches. The Plishtim treat their idols and the Aron with respect, it seems, you know, again, debatable, but it seems like it's with respect. And the Plishtim return the Aron in a way which proves divine supervision, the whole thing with the cows and the, you know, having their young held behind, and the new wagon and the whole business. Okay. Perek Zayin. There is a 20-year period in which, by the end of which, the Jews have done tshuva. It was unclear to us, did you tshuva at the beginning of the 20 years, through the 20 years, unclear. But at some point, during or at the end of the 20 years, Shmuel holds a major national gathering, they reject idols, they accept the service of Hashem. The Plishtim see this gathering, they attack, Hashem defends us, we rout them, and everything is wonderful till the end of the Perek. And then Perek Chet, chapter 8. The nation says, we want a king. Shmuel says, that's a terrible idea. God says, go along with it. It's not about you. It's not you. It's me. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. We asked why that was. We gave multiple explanations. The one that I found fit the psukim best for me was that the nation wants the king to be a human arbiter of justice. That's what they are looking for from this king. Whereas Hashem says, go along with it and don't worry about it, because at the end I'm appointing the king and the king is going to follow my instructions anyway. And Shmuel outlines what kings are supposed to do. Well, not what kings will do. And we said there's a debate. The Gemara seems to think that these are actual powers of a king, to take your children and make them serve him, to take your fields, to take your property, whatever it is. And the other view, which most of the commentators on the text itself in Shmuel say, is that he's describing the excesses of the kings. He's saying, you should know, you want a king. The kings are going to do these terrible things. You don't really want a king. Nonetheless, in Prakim 9 and 10, Hashem arranges for Shaul to meet Shmuel when he's looking for the lost donkeys. Shmuel convinces Shaul that in fact, yes, I'm a real Navi. He tells him all these things. He knew in a day in advance that he was coming and so forth. He anoints him, dedicating him to the service of Hashem. He sets Shaul on a journey on which he will learn about being a king. He meets the different people along the way with the different gifts and so forth. Some of the people reject Shaul when he is officially held up as the king, either because they think he can't help them or because they see him as Hashem's representative. And he goes home. And then we have Perek Yud Aleph with Nachash attacking Yabesh Gilad, the nation defending under Shaul, and Shaul spares the people who reject him. I think these are people who still reject him. Not people who rejected him before. I think that was the evidence of it. We discussed that a little bit last week. Demonstrates mercy and humility. Shmuel holds a new coronation ceremony, and now Shaul is king. Clear? Okay. Let's look at Perek Yud Bet then. That was a 5-minute review of where we've been. We'll probably do that again in September when we start.
That would be a good sense.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, looking at a starting date of Thursday, September 5th, God willing.
Sure.
Right after Labor Day weekend. Start that week because you only have a couple of weeks and then you hit Rosh Hashanah. So this will be enough time for us to get back into Shmuel to then forget about him over Sukkot. That's the plan. Okay. So this parak has three parts to it. It starts out with five psukim in which Shmuel justifies himself before the nation. We've already looked ahead at this to talk about Shmuel's selflessness, but we'll see it now here. Then, the next nine psukim are Shmuel's call for the nation to be loyal to Hashem, and it will wrap up with a devastating miracle that Shmuel brings. It is harvest time, and Shmuel is going to bring rain, which is the last thing you want at the time of the harvest. It's destructive for whatever's in the fields. It keeps you from doing the harvest. It's the last thing that you want at that point. Key questions we're going to need to look at are, first of all, this whole speech that comes before the miracle, and even the miracle. Why? Why now? Shmuel is not about to die. Shmuel has life yet to go. So it's not he's not Yaakov on his deathbed giving brachos to each of the Shvatim. He's not even Moshe, you know, at the end of his life giving a speech before he goes. He also didn't give this speech, which includes major elements of instruction and rebuke, when they asked for a king. Right? He said to them then, that's a terrible idea. You should be following God. But he did not give them this whole speech then. So what is this speech doing here is one question we have to discuss. Second is, when Shmuel goes through his self-justification, his, I didn't take anything from anybody, that whole speech, how much of that speech is about Shmuel? How much of it is about Shaul? And how much of it is actually about the nation? Or maybe something else entirely. What's the goal of his opening segment? And then finally, when we get to the miracle, is Shmuel's harvest rain meant as a miracle? Just like showing Hashem is with you and Hashem still does things? Is it punishment? You know, what exactly is this? That we're not going to get to at all today. But those are a few questions we need to think about. And, you know, you're going to read the parag ahead over the summer anyway, so now you know. So let's look at the opening psukim. Vayomer Shmuel kol Yisrael. Shmuel says to all Israel, everybody seems to assume this is right after the events in Perek Yud Aleph. So Shaul has been accepted as a king, they did a big coronation and so forth. Hinei shamati v'kolchem v'cholash amartem li. I listened to everything you said to me. V'amlich alechem melech, I gave you a king. Ve'ata, and now. Hinei ha-melech mishalech lifnechem. The king walks before you. V'ani zakanti v'savti. And I have gotten old. Zakanti, that's one level, and savti, seva, suggests even older.
Gray hair.
And then some. The uvanai hinam itchem. And my sons, they're here with you. Vani hishalachti lifnechem minu rayat ayom hazeh. And I have walked before you from my youth, literally, right? We know he went to the Mishkan as soon as he was weaned. The ayom hazeh to this very day. Hineni anuvi. Here I am. Answer me. Neged Hashem, opposite God, v'neged Mishicho, and opposite God's anointed one, meaning Shaul. Es shor mila kachti, whose ox have I taken? V'chamor mila kachti, whose donkey have I taken? By the way, just worth thinking about, because this week we're going to lay in Korach, right? Mm-hmm. Moshe is going to give the same speech, right? Lo chamor echad mehem nasati, I didn't take any donkeys from them. Right? And keep in mind that the connection is an important connection because, of course, Moshe is a Levi, right? And Korach is the Levi who challenges Moshe, and Shmuel is a Levi. There's all sorts of discussion about Gilgal, reincarnation within this as well. But I'm just pointing out to you the association between Moshe saying, I didn't take anything from them, and now you get Shmuel defending himself, saying, "You know, you tell me, whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? V'esmi ashakti, who have I cheated? Esmi ratzosi, who have I crushed? Umiyad Mila, there are different explanations of Ratzos. It doesn't have to be crushed.
This is reminiscent of Yaakov when he's leaving Laban's house.
Yes, it is.
When he's explaining.
You got it. It's the same statement of why are you giving me such a hard time?
Yeah.
The Umiyad Mila Kachti Kofer. And from whom have I taken any payment? The Alimenai Bo, such that I didn't look upon him. Meaning, there are two different explanations. Either, when I judged cases, who did I take payment from to ignore him in? Just in judgment, that's one take. Or alternatively, from whom did I take payment? I am now going to look away so that if anybody wants to make the claim to the nation and not have me know they're the ones making the claim, I won't see. Two different ways to read it. The former one is the one that seems to be more grammatically correct based on that vav in the beginning, but not necessarily. You could make the argument both ways. V'ashiv lachem, but he says, I'll pay you back. Whatever I took, I'll pay it back. Vayomaru, and they said, Lo ashaktanu, you haven't stolen from us. Velo ratzosanu, you didn't cheat us, you didn't crush us, nothing. Velo lakachta miyadish me'uma, you took nothing from anybody. Vayomar aleihem, and he says back to them, Eid Hashem bachem, God is my witness, he says. Ve'eid mishicho hayom hazeh, and his anointed one, Shaul, is the witness on hayom hazeh on this day. Kilo mitzasem biyadi me'uma. You have not found anything wrong with me. Vayomer, eight. Witness. Yes. It's really dramatic as an introduction. What questions does this raise?
Why is he saying all this?
Well, you tell me. Has somebody accused him of something? Dad, can you pass me your talk for a second?
Yeah.
Thank you. I want to see something. They spelled Harkind wrong, really?
How do you spell Harkind?
H-E-A-R. They spelled Harkind right.
No, they spelled Harkind.
Okay. You're thinking of Hark, the Herald Angels thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. The Charlie Brown. The but I wanted to check your Tanakh, not because of that, but because they noted in here. That's what I thought. This is actually the Haftarah for Korach. Because it's the descendant Shmuel making this claim. So yeah, they note the Haftarah in here, so you can see it there. Okay, so so one question you have to ask is the
maybe they're united collective now.
The is that it's in the singular, and he says, who is the he? The easiest answer is the nation said. We'll see other ways to take it as well. What else is strange here? Well, I mean, my opening question, right? Why do we have this defensive introduction here at all?
It's so detailed. So many different things. Just say, have I done anything bad? And they can say,
but there's one clause here that doesn't fit.
Say that.
There's one clause here that really doesn't fit the speech in these psukim.
Mm-hmm. What? Redemption money.
Redemption money is ransom, really. And the way the Torah has a specific mitzvah that you're not allowed to take kofar if somebody committed murder to allow him to go free. So it would be more or less a bribe payment in order to escape. Yeah, then that's a reasonable translation.
What does he need to make restitution for if he hasn't done it?
No, he's saying I didn't take any payment from anybody. That's what he's saying. But in Pasuk Bet,
is he also saying, well, I haven't taken anything from you. I haven't done anything wrong. Why did you want a king?
Right. So that's, I think that's the clear precedent for this. And then the question is, well, then why didn't you say it way back then? But he's trying to say, I don't know why you guys went pursuing anything in the first place. I was doing a good job. Mm-hmm. Right? I think that's a clear motivation for this. Yeah, why did he throw in anything here about the sons?
Well, he's comparing his sons to Eli's sons.
But he didn't say that. He said, my sons are here with you. Okay.
Guilty.
So, two different things, Michelle.
I was thinking, maybe he knows. I mean, the sons were involved in things, and maybe some kind of guilty. I don't know.
But what's he saying? What does he think the nation is going to hear when he says this?
Do you know they're bad? I know they're bad.
Yeah, I know. That's what I wanted.
They were bad. Diane?
He wants the sons to hear the same thing so that they'll draw example from it.
He wants the sons to hear the same thing so that they will draw an example from the from it. So another, my sons are standing here, but you're going to call them out in front of the nation? They sit up, they're standing there.
maybe he's old and he's worried he wants his sons to be taken care of. Even though they're bad, I want them to be considered part of the nation, and you're my witness.
Oh, this is great. Not only were they warping justice for their own wealth, now I want them also to get a pension for me.
He's still their father.
Yes, but still. So first of all, when we approach this, recall just because we met, he says, Zakanti Vasavdi, right? I've gotten super old. Remember that we had a debate about that back in Perek Zayin in chapter 7. We noted the Midrashim that assume he lives to be 52 years old, which means he's about 50 at this point in the story. He dies early, according to those Midrashim, in order to avoid seeing Shaul die. Right? The Gemara tells it that Shaul is going to die, and Shmuel doesn't want to see everything that he worked on destroyed, and so he's going to die earlier.
That he's bad. Like, he knows he pulled he took away his kingship before he died.
Right, but he doesn't want to actually see Shaul die. That's what he doesn't want to see.
How long does Shaul
reign? Short, a couple of years. We'll see that. So the Gemara says that then there's a concern that if he dies at such a young age, as Abarbanel notes, none of the righteous people in Tanakh die like before 70. You know, it's unheard of in Tanakh. Everyone's going to think he must have been terrible.
Right.
So the Midrashim say he ages early, he ages prematurely, such that people will not assume he was bad, they'll just say he was sick. Yes, Eddie.
How can Shaul have only been king for a couple of years when he had grown children?
Well, he was older already when he got the position.
No, I thought he was young and looking for the donkeys.
He's looking for the donkeys, yes. Young, not necessarily.
Well, usually you send a young person to go look around.
Okay, but that's the answer. But that is the answer, because we know how long his reign lasts. It's clear in the story. But the math for Shmuel to get him to 52 is that Eli becomes the shofet on the day that Chana davens in the Mishkan. Remember we talked about him sitting on the chair?
Okay.
Chana davens then, and then Shmuel is born a year later. We know that Eli is the shofet for 40 years, because the text says so. So that means that Shmuel and Eli overlap for 39 years. Shmuel then has 11 years when he's in charge, and then Shaul lives another 2 years. Shmuel lives another 2 years. Not Shaul, it's a mistake in my notes. Shmuel lives another 2 years, and he dies 4 months before Shaul dies. That's the way that it works, and that goes back to our discussion about the 20 years, and that what that means is that the people were good for 20 years, but Shmuel does his big, festival or whatever that is with them in the middle of the 20 years, not at the end of the 20 years. Ralbag and Abarbanel did not accept this idea. They contended that Shmuel lived longer than 52, into his 70s at least. We talked about that then. Two added comments from the commentators, though, on our perek. First of all, Radak says, you really don't have to think that Eli's era as Shofet began that day. You know, you could say he became the Kohen Gadol on that day if you want. It doesn't have to be a shofet starting on that day, and therefore Shmuel could be older now. So Radak, justifies the narrative of Ralbag and Abarbanel that in fact Shmuel could be older. And Malbim, interestingly, gives it an entirely different view. He has an entirely different view. He buys the chronology. He buys the idea that Shmuel is only 52. But in terms of his aging, if you look at source number 11, he says, when Shmuel says, I got old, Vanilo hisagti shum tova, chilef avodasi asher avaratechem. I don't know how to do that word. Avaratechem, that's not a word.
I work for you.
I get it, but it's a weird word. In any case, Malbim knows grammar better than I do. That's for sure. But he says, I didn't benefit at all from all the work I did for you. Ani zakanti merov avoda v'ol hatzibur. I got old because of all the work and the yoke of serving the community. Shayadezek kaptal aizikna shalob izmana. That's why I aged prematurely. So he's taking an entirely different approach. Not that Hashem ages him prematurely, but that it's because of the workload. And he's saying to the nation, you did this to me.
Sounds bitter.
Yes. It's an accusation. And then he says, I didn't take anything. Now, there are different ways to understand what he's trying to say here, and we're going to see three different approaches to his speech in general. But before we get to that, Just a couple of notes. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on Pasuk Gimel, where he tells you, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, I didn't do that, you know? There are different reads in the commentators about what he is saying here. Malbim has it as a structure, there's a hierarchy to the things that he says he didn't do. Yeah, I didn't steal, I didn't take things by pressing somebody to give it to me, I didn't even take things when people wanted to give it to me willingly. I just didn't want to go into all the commentary on it. I felt it's a distraction for us. But the other thing I do want to note is that Shmuel, according to the Gemara, does not starve. It's not like he's broke his whole life. Take a look at source number 12, the Gemara in Nedarim, Amar Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan says, Kol ha-nevi'im ashirim hayu. All the prophets were wealthy. Minolan, how do you know that? Mi Moshe, umi Shmuel, me Amos, umi Yonah. And they give you psukim for each of these, Moshe, Shmuel, Amos, and Yonah, to try to argue that they were wealthy. So for example, Yonah goes down to the water to get a boat, and it says he hired the boat. Suggesting that he bought the boat, you know. He just said, forget, you know, I'm renting this for a private cruise. That's Yonah. For Shmuel, they say the fact that he goes everywhere, he makes his circuit, and his house is with him, suggests that he had stuff with him wherever he went that he could use to set up shop and to have his own domicile. He had enough goods with him that he was able to do it. He didn't need to take from anybody.
So where did he get that? He was a 3-year-old boy when he...
Right. So the question is, yeah, it must have been somewhere in the family. That will be the answer. Well, we don't know whether people paid or not.
What,
we had that weird story, and the answer would be inheritance.
From where?
Well, that's the question. I don't know.
Well, to do it was every year to the temple.
Every year a robe, any robe.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, the Gemara ends up showing that you could challenge the evidence that it brings to show that they're wealthy, and it just says, okay, so this is a tradition. We just know it to be true. Whether you can prove it from the sentences, you can't prove it from the sentences. The Gemara says we have a tradition that the prophets were not broke. The reason why this is particularly important, right? Why does it matter whether they were wealthy or not? Why does this matter? So one is to say they don't need to worry about bribery, right? There's no. Right, but that just highlights the problem that they have. That they're taking even they don't even need it. Right, even when they don't need. But one element of it is, I think you're right. I think to say they don't need to take from anybody, and that's one piece. I think another piece of it is Hashem's affection for them. Hashem is protecting them and looking after them. I think that's another way to read it. And then the other one comes from Amos. When Amos gives his anti-monarchy speeches, at what point a priest comes out, Amatziah, and says to him, go somewhere else and prophesy for your bread. It's an insult to say, like, you just do this for the coins that someone is going to give you. You claim to be offering prophecy. So what it's saying is the opposite. They actually were wealthy. They weren't doing this for their enrichment. Okay. We have three approaches to this speech and this defensive introduction and how it relates to the rest of the parak, and I gave it to you a number 13 as bullet points. One approach here is that this is an instruction for the future. The rest of the parak is going to be a history lesson. Look at all the things God did for you, and therefore you should be loyal. But he starts out by saying, here is your model for behavior. This is the man I was. I didn't take anything from anybody. I was straight and upfront. That's the way you ought to be. That's your first approach. Second approach, and we're going to go through each of them and show how they fit. I'm not just, putting the bullet points out there. The second approach is that this is his retirement party.
Yeah.
I anointed Shaul, right? I've made Shaul king. I'm done. And so he defends his record for them. And then after that, he's going to go into, and here's what I think should happen, State of the Union. But first he has to defend his record, and now Barbanel's going to have a fascinating note on that. And then the third approach, which is Barbanel's major idea, is that this is a long-delayed rebuke. Meaning, they asked for a king way back in chapter 8. He held his tongue. Yeah, he told them this is a bad thing. But he primarily held his tongue. Because he didn't want them to say, yeah, you're just trying to avoid you know, giving us a king. So he follows through, gets them a king, and then unloads on them. He says, I did what you asked me to do, but now I got a lot to talk about. Because he's very upset at what they did when they asked, as we're going to see. We're now going to walk through each of these three approaches. So the first approach is fairly straightforward. It is instruction for their conduct going forward. Right? If you take a look at Rabag that I brought you in source number 14, he says, V'achar zeh, after this, Hishtadel Shmuel Lahavias Yisraelu Malkam El Sheis Nagu Bedarche Atar Velo Yisru Mimena. Shmuel tried to bring Israel and their king to the point where they would act according to Torah. They would not leave it. V'zachar Lahem Tchila Shekol Yamam Inhigam Bedarche Atar. So first he said, you know, I led you in the way of Torah my whole career. Me'ayin Neso Panim La'adam. I never showed favor to anybody. V'lo Kacham Shum Davar. I never took anything from anybody. And I think what he's doing is he's giving them rebuke to get them in line, which fits with a medrash in the Sifri in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, which points out that others also rebuked the nation only right before they died. Not Moshe. Moshe had various opportunities to rebuke the nation, but Yehoshua, before he died, gave them a rebuke, two really, and David, before he dies, also offers a message of rebuke according to the Sifri. So you can see the model here is he's not really going to die yet. He's still got some time, but I mean, he feels it. He says, "Zakanti vasavti, I'm already old." Okay, so that's one approach, and it's a straightforward approach. But then you get the retirement party approach, and the Dat Mikra. Right? Professor Eli Tzur says this in number 15. He says, in the interest of time, I'm just going to do this in the English. With Shaul's renewed reign, Shmuel ceased to function as a shofet and national leader who brought them out and in, who rescued them from their enemies. Therefore, Shmuel came to separate from the nation. And like his predecessors as leaders, Moshe and Yehoshua, he summarized the era of his leadership and the general era in his last words. So we didn't get to the sons yet. We are getting to them. Because again, this is his retirement party. Good luck, Shaul. But Abarbanel has this really interesting note. Look at number 16. He says, he, Shmuel, said this because when a judge left his trade, the practice among the nations was that the next judge would investigate his deeds. Right? Not like today where you pardon your predecessor. And if it will be found that he had taken a bribe, then he will punish him for it. Because Israel said to appoint a judge to judge them like all of the nations, Shmuel wished to do this too, like the nations. Thus he said, and opposite his anointed one, that Shaul should judge whether he had acted inappropriately. He said, I'm doing this in front of God and in front of Shaul. And he said there was no need to be bashful or fearful of him. They already had a king. What more could Shmuel do to them? Certainly, as he was elderly and very weak. So according to this read within Abarbanel, it's, I'm retiring and now I have to give an accounting. Now, where is your precedent for that? Where did Abarbanel make this up from? So you have to remember, Abarbanel lives among the political leadership in Spain, Italy, Portugal, depending on when, within his career, which country we had not yet been kicked out of in the Iberian, you know, region. But he often does this. He likes to bring in things that he's familiar with politically. In Yeshaya, we saw the Pentapolis, where he talked about the five cities in Egypt joining together. It's a phenomenon that five cities will join together and be led as one. It was something that he was familiar with as a governance structure. So I said, this has to be from somewhere. So I went hunting and found it. Take a look at source number 17. This was, sure enough, a Spanish practice. Anybody here want to read the Spanish?
Yes. A juicio de residencia.
Sounds great to me. Literally, judgment of residence was a judicial procedure of Castilian law and the laws of the Indies. It consisted of this. At the termination of a public functionary's term, his performance in office was subject to review, and those with grievances against him were entitled to a hearing. This was largely an automatic procedure and did not imply prior suspicion of misconduct. The official was not allowed to leave the place where he exercised his authority, nor to assume another office until the conclusion of this judicial inquiry. Generally, the person charged with directing the inquiry was that individual already named to succeed to the position. Mishicha, right? The one who's now going to be the new one. The penalties for conviction varied, but generally consisted of fines. I found this in a couple of different sources. I think Abarbanel is anachronistic, meaning the fact that it existed in you know, the lands that he was familiar with in the 15th century does not mean that that was what was going on in Shmuel's day. But it's entirely possible that it was just an expression in his day for something that was being done before. And that, in fact, was that old. And I see no reason to discard the idea.
It's not part of the Spanish. It's just juicio de resistencia.
Okay. But the idea here is that that he has to defend himself. It's part of his job at this point. But it's interesting to note the Da'at Mikra's parallel to Moshe and Yehoshua. They gave closing speeches also, but those speeches were much heavier on instruction for future conduct. They didn't have the self-justification that Shmuel does. Moshe says, I have already old, I can't go out, which the Medrash discusses. Does he mean he can't go out because God won't let him, or is it because he's actually infirm at that point? But we don't have Moshe present a defense of his career. Yehoshua just says in his speech that he distributed the land. But again, you don't see a defense of his career. You do see it with Shmuel. He's much more personal. And presumably it's because he's the only one of the three whom the people tried to replace. The people didn't try to unseat, I mean, Korach tried to unseat Moshe, but, you know, Korach is gone by the time Moshe gives his speech. Korach has been on for 40 years. Shmuel is responding to this attempt to dethrone him. And so he feels, I need to do that. There's defensiveness to it. All right, there's more to see about how this fits into the psukim, and so we have to see approach number three. So we're just going to have to resume September 5th, right where we left off. I will start us off with a review, not to worry. Have a wonderful summer.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. I've been having a great time with this.
Thank you.